This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, the hearings will continue into September's Merrimack Valley gas explosions. A state hearing is scheduled next week. Yesterday, those directly affected got a chance to air their concerns during a federal hearing in Lawrence. Among those who spoke was Luciani Rondon, sister of Lionel Rondon, the 18-year-old man killed in the explosions.
We will not have the joy of seeing the wonderful man we know he would have become. I stand in front of you in his honor. I will never have my brother back. But we hope there will be justice for him in the community.
Senator Ed Markey led yesterday's special federal hearing in Lawrence, and he joins us on the phone. Hi there, Senator Markey. Hello, Senator, are you with us?
No, I'm here. Yeah, great. Good afternoon.
Great
to be with you.
Yeah, nice to be with you, too. You were among those at the hearing yesterday calling on the Columbia Gas executives to step down because of the way these explosions have been handled. Why?
Well, they had plenty of warning. They decided at each step to choose safety over savings. To make easy decisions over the right decisions. And ultimately, it's pretty clear that there were plenty of opportunities for this company to have put in place the safeguards which could have avoided this catastrophic event.
Well, what we know so far from this event, Senator, and fill in the blanks here if I'm misrepresenting this, but investigators have put much of the blame on an engineer. They say that a construction crew replacing a gas pipeline in South Lawrence mistakenly left a pressure sensor on an abandoned pipe and then didn't put a new sensor on the new pipe. So therefore, when one of them was registering low pressure, more gas was coming into the system and it overburdened it. So I'm just wondering, is that what happened here? And if that's the case, from what we've learned from the National Transportation Safety Board investigation, I wonder what role regulators have here in terms of making sure that the sensors are on the proper pipes and that they're functioning properly. Isn't that also a regulatory issue?
Yes, it's both. Both the company had responsibility, and the regulators had responsibility. There was a climate that is ultimately created from the federal level by the Pipeline Safety Agency, which was there yesterday to testify, which allows for a lowest common denominator set of safety procedures to be put in place. There is very little oversight, and in that atmosphere, Columbia Gas allowed an underqualified, uninformed engineer to unilaterally approve the pipeline construction work plans that caused the entire disaster. So that showed a total breakdown of safety culture and management, and we still don't have a clear answer of how the failure to consult experienced technicians could have been allowed to happen, and whether it happened on other jobs across the Commonwealth. But ultimately, Columbia Gas never expected that a disaster of this magnitude could happen. And as a result, they were not prepared to prevent it or to respond to it. Yes, one unqualified engineer did play a terrible role, but this goes beyond one individual. This is a culture which was opposed to really strong safety protections being put in place.
And how did you see that? How did you see that there was a culture at Columbia Gas that was opposed to taking stronger safety steps?
They had a policy at the company 4 years ago, for example, that would have had somebody in place to be able to monitor what was going on. But they decided 4 years ago to just discontinue that extra level of safety precaution that could have potentially prevented this accident. So we could see that there was a shortchanging, which did take place over time, and it manifested itself in multiple ways.
Do we know anything further about when service might be restored? The initial deadline, I believe, was November 19th. Then that was pushed back to December 16th. Is that a realistic time frame as to when these families might get service restored? Is that your understanding?
That's what they're saying. But again, this is almost a take-home exam for the company. So they gave themselves a November deadline, and then they missed it. Now they're giving themselves a December deadline. There's no guarantee that they're going to meet it. Part of the reason why I wanted to have a hearing up there was to make sure that they're going to be watched very closely over the next several weeks to ensure that they do not shortchange or short-circuit the telescoping of the time frame, which it's going to take to make sure that everyone, every business, every residential home has the service which they need.
Let's make sure that we get you to talk about a few other things. I want to ask you a bit about the situation involving a Massachusetts woman, Sandra Hahn, and her two adult children. They are apparently not allowed to leave China. Now, you've tweeted that your office is aware of this situation. Apparently, police in China say that they are trying to get to the father of the two adult children, and they would like the father to return to China to face criminal charges. Now, the mother and these two adult children are American citizens. Have you been able to speak with them?
Well, we're as you said, we're aware of the issue, and that's why I tweeted out. We are working actually with federal agencies, and I hope we will safely help them to return home. That's my goal, is to wade in with the feds to make sure that we do everything we can to help the family.
So what does that mean? What can you say? What exactly is happening to try to get them back from China?
Well, I have a person who is an expert on these types of issues on my staff, and she is working on it right now, and we're trying to keep open lines of communication so that everyone knows of our interest and how important it is for this to be resolved positively for the family.
Mm-hmm. So you haven't spoken with Sandra Hahn, the woman involved here, directly?
I have not spoken personally.
Or anyone from your office?
But my staff is working, you know, to accomplish the goal, yes.
Now, China says that what is happening here is that this is an exit ban, which it says that it sometimes uses to try to coerce people into giving the country information, especially when there are criminal cases involved. I mean, what would you say to other citizens who might be concerned about this? I mean, is there any kind of legal precedent that you're aware of where U.S. citizens would be protected from this?
China ultimately is a communist state. They play hardball. You know, they try to extract as many concessions as they can in every single instance. It doesn't make any difference what the subject is. That's just how they play the game. So from my perspective, they just should know that we're organizing to guarantee that they feel a pushback, and we're working with Senator Cardin from Maryland on the whole exit issue. It's a concern, and we need to address it. But we're going to use this individual case as a way to get an insight into the way in which the Chinese operate.
Legal marijuana shops, too, opened in Massachusetts last week. There's legislation pending in Congress regarding marijuana, descheduling it from the list of federal drugs that are illegal, also possibly expunging federal marijuana convictions. Where do you stand on that?
On which bill is it?
On how about Cory Booker's legislation that would legalize marijuana and expunge federal marijuana convictions?
Well, I would have to look at the specific details of Senator Booker's bill. From my perspective, I'm very interested in learning from the implementation of our own state law to garner from our own experience what is unfolding, what the impacts are going to be, and then that will inform my judgment as to then what should be included in any national legislation as it moves forward.
But do you think that there needs to be change on the federal level regarding marijuana and the legalization of marijuana? Because now there are 10 states where it's legal on the state level but not on the federal level. Does something have
absolutely.
To give...
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. We can't have a federal policy which contradicts what is going on at the state level. The state of Massachusetts should have the right to determine what the relationship is between our 6.7 million people and marijuana. And we don't need the Trump Justice Department, the Trump White House trying to move in for political grandstanding purposes upset consensus that has been created, not just in Massachusetts, but in Colorado and Washington State, which are serving as the laboratories in learning more about the issue. But we just can't have the Trump administration trying to upset the progress which we're making.
Lastly, I'd like to hear your thoughts about the future of the Democratic Party a bit. We will be hearing from Congressman Seth Moulton in just a moment. But the Boston Globe is running a piece today suggesting that you might be vulnerable in the 2020 election. It says because you're a white male incumbent who's been in Congress for more than 40 years, this could make you vulnerable, particularly after the race where Congresswoman-elect Ayanna Pressley defeated longtime incumbent Mike Capuano. I mean, does it make you leery? Do you get a message from the Pressley victory there?
We haven't even finished this cycle yet. We still have a special election in Mississippi to determine how many senators that we're going to have seated in January. And the way in which I always view the election cycle is I just do my best. I work hard. I fight for the things that the people of Massachusetts send me to Washington to do. I did that up in Lawrence yesterday by bringing a Senate committee to Lawrence so that their concerns would be heard. That's a rare occurrence, but it's something that I thought was important. The same thing is true on climate change, on privacy, on immigration policy, on criminal justice reform. The issues which I work on are the issues which are of concern to the people in Massachusetts, and I do my best, you know, to be the leader on net neutrality, to be a leader in ensuring there's NIH funding for biomedical research, and at the end of the day, I am I'm going to do my best to push back hard on the Trump administration with a Democratic House in the new Congress, and we're going to fight the Trump administration every step of the way to ensure that they don't implement policies which are harmful to the state of Massachusetts, but to the entire country.
So you're not necessarily taking any strong message from the Ayanna Pressley victory and thinking that there might be, that you might be vulnerable because there might be a movement to getting more fresh faces in Congress.
I do my best to be at the cutting edge of every issue that affects the state of Massachusetts and our country. And on those issues, I fight and do my best to actually implement policies that are going to be effective, and that includes my success on the floor of the United States Senate on net neutrality this year, my work on climate change, my work on pipeline safety. It doesn't make any difference what the issue is. I just continue to fight. And my message is that Donald Trump cannot make America great again by making America hate again. And amongst other things, we have to fight to make sure that we have criminal justice reform, because we owe an apology to an entire generation of African-American young men that we incarcerated in the 1990s as part of the war on crack cocaine. And my job is to just keep fighting, energized every day with the, you know, to respond to the attacks being launched by the Trump administration. And I have a reason to get up every day, which is what I do. I have never been more energized than I am right now to get up and fight, you know, for the things that Massachusetts stands for.
Okay.
And it is an honor to have the opportunity to do that.
All right, Senator, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Staying with politics now, we turn from the Senate to the House, where Democrats picked up 39 seats in the midterm elections this month. That's more than enough for Democrats to retake the majority in the House, which means the party will be choosing the next speaker in January. Tomorrow, Democrats elect their nominee for speaker, and it's widely expected that Nancy Pelosi will be chosen, but not all Democrats are on board. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton is among a vocal group of Democrats pushing for new leadership. Moulton has taken some heat about this, including during a tense town hall meeting in Amesbury last week. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks caught up with Congressman Moulton yesterday, and Anthony is with us in studio. Welcome.
Hey, hi, Deb.
So does Congressman Moulton have the votes to block Nancy Pelosi?
All right. Well, he says he does, and depending on how you look at the math, maybe he does. If 16 Democrats vote against Pelosi, she would be blocked when the full House votes next January. We know that Moulton is among a group of 15 Democrats, plus there are four newly elected members of Congress, all of whom say they oppose Pelosi. They have said that. But, Deb, the math changes daily because Pelosi is working hard to round up support. I mean, for example, she convinced one of the Democrats who signed that letter with Moulton last week saying they'd vote against her to support her. And she convinced Marcia Fudge, the Ohio congresswoman who Moulton hoped would challenge Pelosi and run for speaker, to support her as well. And right now, and this is the point, right now there's nobody who has said they want to run against her. So most observers expect her to have the votes to become speaker next January. Among other things, she's very good at vote counting and getting lining up support for issues and people that she cares about. So the money is on her being speaker again.
Now, you asked Congressman Moulton about his stand against Pelosi. What did he tell you?
Well, he's been saying for some time that the Democrats need new leadership. But it's interesting because now he's shifted his focus away from Pelosi exclusively and is talking about the entire three-person leadership team, calling for a conversation or a negotiation with Pelosi about promoting younger members of the caucus into the leadership. So to many, that sounds like a softening of his position, saying, hey, let's negotiate. So as you said, I spoke to Congressman Moulton yesterday about all of this, and let's listen to a bit of what he said.
No, I think it's time for a new generation of leadership in the House. I think that we ought to answer the call that the American people sent in the election 2 weeks ago for new ideas, new leadership, and a new way forward. If we simply respond by reinstalling the same three top leaders, it's not just Pelosi here, it's three top leaders in the House of Representatives who have been stagnant in the same position for more than a decade. That's not the right message for a country that needs to move forward, for a party that needs to respond to a totally different world. It's not the same world as we had in 2006.
So one of the things that I'm intrigued about is one of the things you said at your town hall meeting, and I think you just sort of said it right then, was that the American people basically voted for change. But didn't they get change in that they flipped the House from Republican leadership to Democratic leadership? I mean, isn't that the change they voted for?
I think they voted for a lot more than that. I don't think that just simply flipping the majority is enough. I think that we need to be fundamentally a government that's willing to take on the new challenges of the day. We're the party of the future. Democrats are the party of the future. We should be legislating on things like privacy and social media. Right now, the Europeans are setting the rules of the game. We should be talking about how to regulate drones. You know, I had a drone fly over my house 2 afternoons ago. Who's talking about what the privacy concerns are there? We need to deal with the automated workforce and the fact that our education isn't set up to respond to the demands of the new automated workforce, that so many Americans are finding themselves automated out of their jobs. And we need people who understand the tragedies of today, like gun violence, the gun violence problem, to really take those issues on for the American people. We had a at the town hall in Amesbury, this amazing 17-year-old.
I heard her. She was something.
She was incredible. And really, frankly, ignored by the press. But it was, I think, one of the most powerful speakers at that town hall. And she said, nobody in Washington understands what it's like to go to school every single day and fear for your life. Because frankly, people just haven't grown up in that generation.
Well, let me stick with that gun control thing and a new generation of leadership, because this is an interesting subject to me. And I agree, she deserved more attention from the press and myself included. However, we had a new generation of leadership in the White House. Barack Obama, Sandy Hook happened. He cried on national TV. He couldn't get anything done on gun control. So I'm asking you, is a new generation of leadership really going to be able to move that particular ball down the field?
Well, frankly, not if we just have the same leadership in the House. And that's the whole point here, yeah. Is that, as you just said, the president called for change. Congress didn't deliver. And I just don't have confidence that we're going to deliver for the American people if we do not get leadership that's more reflective of the American people today.
Mm. So who's your candidate? Who is this person if not Nancy Pelosi?
Well, look, this is the question that everybody's asking. And I'll be honest, of course, we would rather have a candidate who's come forward at this point. But what we've heard from all the people who are considering a challenge, who may or may not be, you know, organizing behind the scenes right now, is that they don't want to come forward until it's clear that she does not have the votes on the floor of the House. So look, count me among the people who wish strongly that someone would step up by now. I agree that that would be helpful to our effort, without a doubt. But unfortunately, the political reality of the stranglehold that our current leadership team has in the House is that no one wants to step up before it's clear that they're going to step down.
Well, you're one of the leaders of this push. Why not you? Why not put yourself for it?
Pelosi has tried to dub me one of the leaders of this. This is a broad-based sentiment in the caucus. But I've made it clear from the very beginning that I'm not going to run.
This idea of, you know, hashtag five guys going after Nancy Pelosi, that sort of stuff, I understand that it's not just white guys. But isn't there an appearance issue? I mean, Nancy Pelosi is, you know, the highest ranking Democratic woman in American history. And sort of focusing on her sends a signal that you heard about from your constituents at the town hall meeting last week. People are upset about it. What do you say to them? Because it is a powerful symbol.
Let's just understand what's going on here. We've called for change for the top three.
Yeah.
From the very beginning. And this has been a position I've had for 2 years. So this has never been a focus on Leader Pelosi. Now, it is true that the freshmen who won the majority for us, many of them made a promise specifically not to support her as a condition in their campaigns. And so we tailored our letter to fit that promise that the freshmen made. But let's be clear, from the very beginning and all the way through, this has been a call for generational change in all the top positions in our leadership.
One more question about Pelosi. Respond to the idea that of all times, this is sort of incredibly important to have a woman like Pelosi in there, a sort of master vote counter, someone who understands parliamentary procedure better than anybody because she has the experience. What's the argument against that right now?
We now have 234 Democrats in the House. The idea that there's only a couple people who can do this job and do it well and really bring our country forward, that people will look at and say, there's a speaker that represents the future of our party and the future of the country. That's what we're looking for. And the idea that there's only a couple people who can do that, I think, is frankly absurd.
There was a piece in the Washington Post just a few hours ago that suggested that you might be interested in negotiating directly with Nancy Pelosi, supporting her if she would be open to change within the rest of the leadership. Any truth to that?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the Washington Post suggested. But look, we're Democrats who are willing to talk about solutions for transition here. I mean, I think that's a reasonable position to take. But there's no question that we want to see change. And that's what the American people demand. That's what the freshmen who won the majority have demanded as a condition of getting elected. And that's what we're supporting.
That's Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, who represents the 6th District. He was speaking with WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks yesterday about his push for change in Democratic leadership. And Anthony's with us in studio. Anthony, do you think Moulton risks any political damage here?
I mean, it's possible. Time will tell. I mean, maybe he loses support, particularly among women, many of whom were angry about his focus on Pelosi. On the other hand, Moulton ran against an incumbent 4 years ago and won. A lot of people probably agree with his message that new blood in the party is a good thing. But, you know, this is one of those things that time's going to tell.
All right. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Deb.
And to read more of Anthony's story about Congressman Moulton, go to our website, WBUR.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.